To begin, I have done a little bit of snooping on you, and I discovered that you were raised in Locust Grove. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Would you like to tell me a little bit about your upbringing?
Well, I grew up here on the Snake Creek Road, a few miles outside of town, and I had three siblings and my parents, and we had a pretty good, pretty meager existence, but very good existence too. And we read a lot of books, and we made lots of trips to the library. And I started writing when I was very young, and I started writing poetry when I was very young, and it just has kind of carried me through my life.
That's wonderful. And you went to OSU for your undergrad and then OU for your master's, correct? Could you tell us about a little bit of your time in college?
Yeah, I went straight to OSU out of high school, and I got a degree in English there after 4 years. And then I kind of basically just floundered around for a while. I actually went from there to Kansas State University and spent a little bit of time there in the graduate program, in the creative writing program. And I taught while I was there, and that's kind of where I got the teaching bug. So I came back to Oklahoma and then actually went to Northeastern State University to take the education courses I needed to get a teaching degree. And so it was after I had my first full-fledged teaching job that I actually got my master's degree at University of Oklahoma.
That's wonderful. And you are a state teacher, as according to the arts. And in terms of teaching, it said that you did stuff for the Impact At-Risk Student Program. Could you give us a little bit of a background on that program and your participation in it?
Yeah, my first teaching job was at Bartlesville High School, and after I had been there for a couple of years, the assistant principal wanted me to start an at-risk student program. At the time, there was a training for something that was called Impact, and they were doing it in Tulsa at the Children's Medical Center. And so I went through that training and then started that program within the high school, and it was basically just a this was This was a long time ago. This was probably in 90, maybe 89, 90. So it was not a real well-known thing to do then, but it was just a program within the school that provided extra help and tutoring and resources and after school and before school and mentoring for students who were at risk of blanking out, basically.
Wow. And how did you find your way back to Locust Grove?
Well, I never would have thought I would come back here. I loved growing up here. I loved growing up here. It was a great town to grow up in, and I have lots of family here. And so I was gone for 25 years, and then it was just one of those things that a lot of people do when they get older, is that they recognize their parents are even older and getting to that point where they might need some help somewhere down the road, and it just felt like it was time to move back and be around them and around family again.
And it seems that Locust Grove has this aura of a communal and artistic focus compared to a lot of other parts of Oklahoma. Did you help harbor that for the town, or was it something that had always been there?
Both. We have some really well-known and fantastic artists from this area, notably Willard Stone and the Glasses Demos and Bill Glass. And there's another Cherokee artist who does work in all kinds of things, mask and jewelry and pottery. Her name's Verna Bates. So they have been around for quite a while, and they have certainly contributed to the atmosphere of the town being artistic one. The shoemakers too, Ben and Joan Shoemaker, wonderful artists in the area. When I moved back, we, with the help of some of my family members, we started an arts alliance. We also started a storytelling group, and we were sort of focused too on trying to get downtown Locust Grove to not really returned to its former glory, because like a lot of small towns nowadays, they're never going to be what they were decades ago, but just wanted it to be a more welcoming place, and that had all the storefronts, had businesses or some sort of activity going on in them. And so we helped with that too, and kind of revitalized the town, and it's really taking off now, I think.
Yeah, and that was a family affair, correct? Because your sister opened a coffee shop in the town as well. And yes. What was it like to have, like, you know, members of your close family help revitalize a town like that? Like, what was the process? Was there a strategy to it?
No, it was just kind of one thing, just little by little, not necessarily a strategy, just a general strategy of wanting there not to be empty buildings on Main Street, and wanting there to be, wanting us to avoid that, the broken window syndrome as a community, and provide a place where it's a really small town, and that's a fairly, it's not a high income town. So we wanted it to be a place too, where people had access to things in the arts and writing and poetry and things that very small communities don't normally have. And so that was definitely our focus too. When my sister Kelly started the coffee shop, the motto was community by the cup, because part of the focus was to have a business, have a coffee shop, but it was to be a gathering place too, and a place to have events. And that's certainly what it has been. That was in 2016. She actually just sold the coffee shop, but the people who purchased it have the same motto in mind, and they're continuing with the same ideas.
And pivoting more towards your contribution to this effort, the history of the Rural Oklahoma Museum seems very interesting. You started that in 2012, correct?
Yes.
Do you mind just running us through the organization and sort of what it does?
Yes, I did start it in 2012 when I moved back here to Locust Grove. My parents gave me a little bit of land, and so I have a house here, out here on a property that a lot of my kinfolk live on. And my dad was a small engine repairman. He had a shop that he had stopped using, and I said, "Hey, one day, can I turn this into a poetry museum?" And he said, "Why not?" So we started ROMP, Rural Oklahoma Museum of Poetry, in his old machine shop. And just from the get-go, I wanted it to be a place where people could come and have an experience of poetry, a positive experience of poetry, because that's just not true for a lot of people, their experiences with poetry. And just because I think that it is a thing that is enriching, and no matter who you are, or what your background is, if you're willing to be open enough to have that experience, it can change you. So yeah, I started that in 2012, and we've moved from that building. We went to another building, and we've expanded. We had a retreat for a while where guests could stay. I started a rummage store in downtown Locust Grove to pay for the museum, because when I started, I was paying for everything out of my personal money, but I couldn't do that anymore. So it is largely funded by the rummage store, and also by organizations like Oklahoma Humanities, which has been one of the best organizations to help us out since we got started. But the original idea was to just have a kind of funky sort of Route 66 roadside attraction, you know, meet some really cool riding adventure for people of all ages and backgrounds. And that's kind of what it's become.
That's so very, very cool. We will touch on the Oklahoma Humanities here in a little bit, but you said riding adventure, and it got me thinking. I think you have a book series that's sort of unique in the fact that it's multimedia and written in prose. Do you want to talk about your origin behind that and some of the influences you had in writing that?
Well, sure. When I was a teenager, I mentioned when I first started, when you first asked me, that as children, we read a lot of books. Mom knew the library, and she would let her check out way too many more books than you were supposed to. And so I started reading Perry Mason books, the Earl Stanley Gardner books, and there were so many of those, and I can still picture the rows of books in the library and just going through them one after another. And they're not great literature, but they're good books, and I really liked them as a teenager. And when I decided to do this book series that I came up with, the Book With series, I got to combine a bunch of things that I love. One of them was Perry Mason, because the detective in it is she loves Perry Mason. In fact, she renamed herself and calls herself Perry. And there are quotes from some of the books throughout my book. And so I got to combine that with another thing that I really enjoy that you can see in the museum is marginalia. And that's the things that people write in old books, not necessarily, you know, annotating what they're reading, but just random notes that they happen to write into books. And so what the series does is this detective, Perry, she is a owner of a used bookstore. And anytime that she gets a book that has things written in it, that kind of poses a little bit of mystery of who was this and why were they writing this and what happened to them, then she explores it and she finds some interesting things. And even a murder one time.
That's very suspenseful. In terms of marginalia, have you found anything in books in your past that really inspired this?
Yeah, the first exhibit in the museum when I opened it, all down the middle of the room was this exhibit on marginalia from a book that I got it's a book from 1938 I picked up in the Salvation Army. It's a high school textbook. Students bought their textbooks, so they wrote in them whatever they wanted to write in them. And she had written notes. You could tell that there was somebody sitting close to her, a friend of hers, because they would write back and forth to one another on the pages. There was a lot of notes on the marginalia of Macbeth in her textbook, but they were just writing notes back and forth to one another, talking to one another about the dances that were coming up. And she would put song lyrics in the margins, and she was always wondering about if so-and-so liked her or not, or if she should ask him to dance when it was the ladies' choice at the high school dance. And so that everything that she wrote in that book kind of inspired a bunch of poetry, and that's, yeah.
It's very elegant. And, I like it.
Yeah, and and that was kind of the basis for the first book I wrote also. And then the third book I wrote was based on an Ogden Nash book of poems that I found in a thrift store, where it was kind of the same thing. A woman had written notes throughout it. They were written to her boyfriend. And that's what my third book was based on. And they are mysteries, but they're written in poetry.
And there's never any clues as to who the person was. Have you ever attempted to contact a person like that? Or does that seem outside the realm of possibility?
The last one I was just talking about, yes, I know exactly who they are, because she put all of their names in there, first names, middle names, last names, their dates in there. They were pretty easy to find online. No, I would not contact them. I have not contacted them, though. And when I wrote, when I wrote the book, I changed their names. But yeah, a lot of my research, I just went straight and online and I found these people.
That's very cool. And the book series, it's multimedia, and you have a couple of people that help you with this, correct?
Yeah, that's where some of our local talent comes in. The first two books, a local artist named Ray Grass, a Cherokee artist, he did the illustrations for those and just did a wonderful job. I gave him the book to read and gave him a few ideas, and he just went for it. On the book, we do a couple. Well, one of the artists that has been a lot in the museum, too, is another local artist. Her name's Alicia Little. and she's done a lot of illustrations for both books and pamphlets and the actual exhibits too.
Wow, Alicia Little. And in addition to Perry, is there any other author or even fictional character that you would say is an inspiration to your art aside from the voices in the margins of books?
Not really. I mean, my poetry is inspired by a lot of poets, and of course that exhibit was also inspired by Billy Collins's poem Marginalia, which is just a wonderful little poem about a note he found inside a Catcher in the Rye book in the library. So I guess just inspiration would just be other poets from my life.
Wonderful. And the museum on Main Street, could you give us a little bit of a background on that? And what it is and what the goal is for that?
Was that the waterways program that we had?
Yeah, I think it was a program. I suppose they had said you were attributed to it, but I suppose not. It was a small rural museum exhibit. But if you don't have recollection of it, I will just move on from that one.
No, I think that's what the Smithsonian exhibit Waterways, I think it fell under that umbrella of Museum on Main Street. Yeah. And that was we were able to get that grant from Oklahoma Humanities. Well, it wasn't really a grant, but we got the opportunity to do the Smithsonian exhibit through them. With the museum's help and with the Locust Grove Arts Alliance and also with the chamber, Locust Grove Chamber, we kind of all went together to get that Smithsonian exhibit in Locust Grove for 6 weeks, I believe. Yeah. The museum had we did a poetry contest on the theme of water, and the Arts Alliance had an art contest on the theme, and we had various events that went with it too. And that was a great thing for the community, you know, going back to what I said earlier about being a small town and not having access to a lot of cultural activities. That was definitely one of them that people could easily come in and experience.
Nice. And backtracking a little bit, the reopening and stuff for ROMP, you said was aided a little bit about Oklahoma Humanities. Can you give us a little background about your interaction with the Oklahoma Humanities, specifically regarding the ROMP?
Yeah. Do you want me to just mention a few of the
your history with it, just whatever.
I went back and looked just to make sure, and we have received funding from Oklahoma Humanities at least 5 times. So that's been wonderful over the course of several years. The first time was when we had the man who was the poet laureate of Oklahoma at the time, Ben Myers. He came to the museum. He did a presentation called Possibilities of Poetry. That was an opportunity grant in 2015. And that was wonderful. He came out in the summer, and he did the whole presentation outside. We had a group circled around him. He talked about the place of poetry in society and in community, and he read his poems, and people got to talk to him and ask him questions about his book, so that was wonderful. We have a poetry festival that we started doing in 2014, or 13 was our first one. But in 2016, the Humanities helped us, Oklahoma Humanities helped us with a grant and to put that one on. And we had Jessica Isaacs, who was an Oklahoma Book Award winner. She was at that event. And last year, our exhibit, because the main theme of the museum exhibit changes every year, we did Justice Not Roses, which was 100th anniversary celebration of the 19th Amendment, women's right to vote, and Oklahoma Humanities helped us out with the grant for the opening celebration and also to help pay for a booklet, which we put together of poetry about 20 different suffragists and photographs and artwork. And the artwork was done by that woman I mentioned earlier, Alicia Little, did some wonderful artwork based on the poems about that I wrote about the women. And that was a great, booklet. And also last year, not too long after that, we got to open and then the pandemic struck. And our main source of income, which is the rummage store, Romp Rummage Store, had to close down. And we were closed for over 2 months. And so we were able to get a HOPE grant, a pandemic emergency grant through Oklahoma Humanities, which was wonderful because I was anticipating having to basically just close down the store because with no income, we didn't have any way of even paying the rent and the utilities. So that got us through. And then up to now, we just a week or so ago, I found out we've been awarded another opportunity grant for our exhibit this year. It's called Firewheel Folk, Oklahoma Wildflowers and Poetry. And so it's going to be a celebration of Oklahoma wildflowers and poetry surrounding them and the history, the ethnobotany of the plants and the language of flowers. And so that's going to be, we're putting the booklet together now for that. And the exhibit is sort of in its final stages. We're going to be opening next month.
Now, what was the inspiration for that? How do you, year after year, come up with these very intricate plans and concepts for these different things? Firewheel Folk, seems so intricate and very interesting.
Just before I wake up in the morning, I have these ideas. I'm serious. They usually come to me in a dream or just when before I wake up in the morning. That's actually how I got the idea for the museum. It was a dream I had. So it's partly that, and partly years ago, I'm a storyteller. I do a lot of just oral storytelling, and I actually run the website for our Oklahoma storytelling group, Territory Tellers. When I was doing some storytelling a long time ago, I worked up a bunch of stories on wildflowers just because I thought that would be neat to tell stories from the point of view of a wildflower. And I called them Firewheel Folk because the firewheel is it's an Indian blanket flower. That's the other names for it. That's our official state wildflower. So I just revisiting that also.
And tell me more about the storytelling group that you run.
Territory Tellers have been around since, I believe, 1984. It's a statewide organization. There are members from all over the state. They do things online. They're doing some virtual storytelling right now. They usually have a festival every summer. It was virtual last year, and I think it might be virtual again this year. It's the first weekend in June, usually. And they just had a winter retreat and online, as I said. And it's just a group that fosters storytelling and the art of storytelling in across the region.
Very cool. And the suffragists, going back a little bit, the suffragist concept from a few years ago, was that also something that you came up with in a dream, or was there any outside influence to it? Or it was the centennial anniversary, correct?
Yeah, I'm not sure that one came in a dream or not, but that, I don't know. I guess I just saw something about it being the centennial, and I thought, oh, that would be so cool to have something like that as the theme for the museum. Because up to that point, the themes have been just pretty, you know, particular to, these are poetic themes, you know, just on poetry. And so that was a way to bring in something that was, you know, event from history and notable real people, and to use their biographical material to immerse people in that history in a poetic way. So that it just seemed like a way to kind of change what the museum had been doing, maybe bring in a few more people and maybe different people because of the theme. And it was really fun and exciting to work with. And it was actually the first time that we hired an artist to come and do the art for the exhibit. Up until that point, I had pretty much just kind of just put it all together myself, but I'm not really a visual artist. So we hired a guy named Brian Gray, who's an artist from Columbus, Ohio, and he came in and lived in the Poets Retreat, right, which was right next to the museum, for a month, and did his artwork and put the whole thing together. And then I just added the poetry and the activities to go with it.
Wow. And how long do these take to set up, to go from the concept to execution?
Usually a month. Yeah. Maybe two. We're getting the one that we're doing right now is taking a little bit of time, but that's mainly because we're actually moving to a whole different location. So in December, this building in town on Main Street became available to rent, and I decided it was time to try and move the museum to town. And so we rented this building, and we did some renovation on it, and now we're putting the exhibit and everything else together in the building. So that's taken a little bit longer than normal.
Yes, March 20th, correct, is when you guys are going to be open to the public, or around that time, I imagine?
Yes, if it's not, hopefully by the 20th, it might be sooner than that. We originally had an opening celebration scheduled for the 20th, but I just recently changed that. We just don't know how the pandemic's going to be, and I just felt like we needed to push that. So we're actually going to do a celebration in July, hopefully. But the museum will definitely be open next month, yeah.
Nice. And do you plan on adding anything to this new site that you could in the older site? Is there like any special things that you'd wanted to do now that you have a different location?
Yes. There's much more space there. So there is one large room, then that will be where the main exhibit is on wildflowers. There's also a small room that's going to be a craft room where we can do extension activities from the exhibit. There is a space that I'm using as both an office and a library. So there'll be a poetry library in there that people can check out books. We have another space where we're going to have a gift shop, which we've never really been able to have, and that will also help us to fund the museum. And then we have there's a full kitchen in this space, and there's a really nice outdoor space too for a garden and to have outdoor events. And then the hallways and the lobbies are going to be places where we have some things from past exhibits and maybe some things of local historical interest and just different types of displays and people's poetry.
Well, it seems like there's a lot of community involvement displaying people's poetry and stuff. Have you had anyone from the past that you've influenced either through teaching or from your poetry come to you and like personally thank you for inspiring them or changing their outlook on poetry or something like that?
Yeah, quite a few times. Yeah, I have.
Wonderful. I imagine that's like a very especially validating feeling as a teacher to have that sort of thing happen to you.
It is. I don't teach anymore except with the Oklahoma Art Council. I'm a teaching artist with them, so I go around and do have gigs with them, but I'm not a full-time teacher. But I definitely have a lot of great experiences and memories and outcomes of the years that I was teaching both high school and college.
Wonderful. Backtracking again a little bit, the poetry festival you mentioned that one of the grands put on, that's different than the exhibits, correct? And he said that's a yearly festival that you guys do.
It's a yearly festival, and it started, I didn't look that up. I think it started in 2013, and we had it out here, and it was just a gathering of people. We had like a poetry poster contest. We were kind of out in the middle of nowhere where Rump first opened. We had this poetry parade that we made across the pasture. We had, it's just kind of a fun celebration of poetry. And then we had for the next 2 years that we had the festival. It's always in April, which is National Poetry Month. We had a poet who was a friend of mine I met back when I lived in Bartlesville. His name's Morris McCorvey. He's an awesome poet and speaker, and he's an actor and a musician. He was the director of the West Side Community Center in Bartlesville for many, many years. He came and he was like the grand marshal of the poetry parade, and he did presentations and readings, and so those were cool events. And then when the coffee shop opened in town, we decided we'd move the festival to town, and then we changed its name and just called it the Wonder City Word Fest. Wonder City is kind of the tagline for Locust Grove. And so we opened it up a little bit at that time. It was still about poetry, but also became about just writing in general. And it also became about pastry. So we had a pastry contest, and that people would enter, and that you could come in and sample, and everybody would write a little haiku about their favorite pastry. And so we did the Word Fest for 3 years, I think, and then last year we weren't able to have it because of the pandemic, and I'm not sure if we're having it this year yet either.
Hopefully future down the line, and that it's not a contingency factor to it, given the state of affairs will be a lot easier to do.
Yes, normally it would be something we would do every April as a part of the celebration of National Poetry Month. It's also the place where I give out the awards for the Oklahoma Poetry Contest, which we sponsor every year. Back when I was teaching high school, the organization called the Oklahoma Poetry Society used to do an annual contest, and that students could enter, and every grade had a different state emblem, like the fiddle or the flycatcher or the buffalo or whatever that they were supposed to write a poem about. And then they'd have a big award ceremony in Oklahoma City, and it was really a neat thing for students. But several years ago, they stopped doing the contest, and when they did, I thought, well, somebody needs to pick this up. So we do an annual contest for all ages, even adults, on just poems about celebrating Oklahoma, and we give those awards out every April at the Word Fest.
Oh, it's good for you to take on the mantle that the state seemed to drop, and the humanities in general seem to be a very, very, fundamentally important aspect. If you could, and this is a rather abstract concept, describe like how the humanities you think are a benefit to society, because it seems as though you do a very good job at, incorporating that into your work and your projects and stuff.
Yeah, it kind of goes along with the mission of the museum that I mentioned earlier, that we are a place where we're trying to bring people and poetry together. We want to increase literacy, and we want to increase an understanding of poetry. And then the main goal is to have an experience of poetry. And so that experience part is the engagement part, the engagement with words and the engagement with other people around words. So it's a community experience. It is a way of sharing culture. It's a way of sharing one another's history. It's like the humanities are. It is a very human experience of that's what the museum has always tried to replicate. And doing that by having a place that is inclusive, that is not a stop, stand, stare museum where you're just kind of observing. You're actually being asked to write on the walls to write a phrase. You don't have to write a whole poem, but write a phrase, put some words together with someone else, share those words by leaving them for other people to read and to add to, and just, you know, kind of be able to be creative without judgment.
Yeah, the culmination of engaging with words and engaging with people, like you said, was very interesting. Do you, as a member of the Arts Council, a teacher that goes, an arts teacher that goes across the state, do you find that there are some places in rural Oklahoma that are sort of starved for this sort of stuff, like the poetry and the humanities and stuff across the state?
In my experience, most schools are starved for it, because, for poetry particularly, because it just seems like so many people are afraid of it, and it is just not something to fear. And that's one of the things that I just, you know, keep hoping that we can change, and that the museum is trying to help with, is to help people to understand that the best way to read poetry, to experience it, to approach it, is just to let it happen, you know, just to read it, just to share it. You don't have to analyze it. You don't have to pick it apart. You don't have to, like Billy Collins said in his poem, Poetry 101, you know, don't beat it with a rubber hose and try to get the meaning out of it. Basically, let it be, and then it can become valuable instead of a scary thing. Yeah. I don't know if that answered the question.
Oh, no, I liked it a lot. It seems as though the waterways exhibit, the mobile Smithsonian thing, is sort of attempting to do that, where it goes around city to city and is a mobile museum exhibit, which is a pretty novel concept. If you had more influence over, was there anything you would implement like in more of a concrete fashion, or just the ticket is purely exposure to these sort of concepts?
Something I would implement in the schools, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, if you could.
Well, I've done a workshop, and I will still do it if anybody wants me to do it. Some of it's online, but it was just something I come up with from years of teaching, that it's not necessarily the poems you choose, it's not the types of lessons that you put together. It's not how much you know about the poets or the poetry or the time period. It's having a poetry friendly environment, or having a poetry friendly classroom, having a place where it's okay just to read a poem and then just move on. Having a place where it's okay to write a poem and not have to share it. Having a place where it's okay to experiment by doing found poems or doing all kinds of non-traditional things that end up being poems. I mean, usually when I had my students write poems, I never told them that's what they were doing. We'd just start, you know, doing it. And by the time we got finished, it was like, oh yeah, now we have a poem. And so it's the environment that you create that makes it that helps poetry to thrive. It's not necessarily any kind of lesson that you can come up with.
Yeah, and in terms of those environments, how, if you were to advise others, how do you nurture that? Because it seems as though openness to interpretation in terms of what is poetry seems to be a pretty big concept. But is there anything else that you think goes into making a pretty pro-poetry environment?
You have to give up control. And it's not like all control, but you have to give up a measure of control, and you have to give up certain amount of pride in your ability as a teacher, because you don't know everything, and you definitely shouldn't expect people to experience something which can be as frightening as poetry seems to be to people. If you are the person who seems to have all the answers or is in control of every, you know, all the knowledge there is about the poem. So you have to be humble. It's humility. Yeah.
So it seems like the freedom is a very important, humility and stuff like that. In terms of your working with the Oklahoma Humanities, what was it like to apply for those grants? Was there any limitations? So did you have to apply with a concept in mind, or was it just you say, hey, and they say, here is some money? What was that like, if you don't mind me getting to the gritty details of your guys' interactions?
Well, I'll tell you this, they have been the most helpful organization in helping me put the applications together. Because when I started, I was clueless about how to do grant application. And I've got a master's degree in English, but the language that of some of these grant applications, I don't know what this means. The money stuff, I definitely am not good at. And so it was just, everyone there was always really helpful. I would send something and they'd send it back and say, you know, how about if you do this? Oh, yeah, okay. So that's been really good. And also, I knew intuitively, I know that what the museum is doing touches on a lot of the different disciplines, and it goes into a lot of areas, but putting a name on them was sometimes difficult. So they were always helpful with that, too, in helping me to identify that, yeah, it's a poetry museum, but this is not just about literature. This is about creativity. There's always history coming in here. There's, like I mentioned earlier, there's ethical considerations. Even with this, the wildflower exhibit that we're going to do, we're having somebody from the Oxley Nature Center is going to come over and give a talk about the ethnobotanical uses of different wildflowers. So there's lots of humanities type things that we're doing that at first, you know, I wouldn't know how to describe them.
Yeah, it just seems like a very cross-disciplinary kind of approach. Yeah. I guess this is just the umbrella of humanities. And this is on behalf of the 50th anniversary of Oklahoma Humanities. And in your experience, in your time here in Oklahoma, do you think that, excluding the incredible leaps that you've made for Locust Grove, are you optimistic to see the humanities sort of introduced and highlighted on across the state? Or do you think that the trajectory is a little more somber than that? Again, withstanding all of the improvements that you and your compatriots have made in the town.
Well, I think it's wonderful. I mean, there was nothing like this when I was growing up here, and there hadn't been in the last few decades. And as I said earlier about the fate of Locust Grove is a small town, like so many small towns in the state, being in decline, especially their downtown areas. It's been proven that the arts and the humanities are a way to bring back a little bit of life to these areas and to add in things that we didn't have before. We're not going to have, you know, when I was young and I would walk down Main Street, there were grocery stores and the doctor was there and the Otasco was there and the drugstore and all of these little shops that we're not going to have again. It's not going to be like that. So the things that we can do, though, in place of them, are provide these kind of experiences and places to gather with people and do art and talk to one another and have lectures and have exhibits on the waterways and whatnot. That's wonderful. I mean, I think that's the direction that that we need to be going, because I don't see, you know, we can't go backwards.
Yeah. And you were mentioning the storefronts and stuff that existed. Did you ever go to museums in Locust Grove? Were any of those sort of a thing in your upbringing that you found especially interesting?
There was no museum here. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Or like anywhere in your upbringing. No. Like maybe across the state on your trips?
When I was growing up, or we're talking a long time ago, this was like the 70s. The only museums I remember going to at that time would have been the Gilcrease and the Philbrook in Tulsa. Yeah.
Those were the ones on the tip of my tongue. I didn't want to assume, though. And how do you think that even the museums have changed over the last 50 years up until what you're doing here with the interactivity of it?
I think they're doing a lot of that also. Well, I know Philbrook is. I haven't actually been to the Gilcrease in a few years, but just things that I've seen online from them, they're doing that also. The Ahal Museum, you know, it's in downtown Tulsa, it's the same kind of thing. It's that they're just really much more family friendly and much more inclusive and interactive than they used to be.
And do you have any guesses as to what you would assume the future of these sort of things are, the future of museums and stuff like that?
I think they'll just keep going in that direction, you know, that they will become places where people aren't just learning about or being entertained by a certain subject, you know, whatever the museum is there for, but that they're able to participate in whatever the museum is about in some way, that they're able to contribute in some little way, that, you know, like they feel like that they are part of the experience of the museum itself.
In a way that sort of ties back into the engagement with words and the engagement with people part that you were mentioning earlier.
Yeah.
So go on. I'm so sorry.
I was just going to add, because just one more thing about museums is there. I mentioned earlier an artist in Locust Grove. He's probably the most well-known artist in this area, Willard Stone. And he had a tiny little museum behind his house. And it is he's a world internationally known sculptor. And they have bought, the museum board has bought an old building. It was actually the first bank building in Locust Grove downtown, and are raising funds to renovate it and to move that museum downtown. And so that would be another, you know, great place for art activities in our little town.
I can't imagine the interactivity possible with the sculpting thing as well. Seems like a very tactile art form. And are there any others besides this Willard Stone, any local artists? You mentioned an Alicia Little as well. Is there anyone else that has sort of like a local small museum in the town?
No, not in the town. Now, I mentioned Verna Bates. She has a studio. It's called Gourds, Etc., because she makes a lot of artwork out of gourds, and she actually grows the gourds there. And her studio and her space is, it's probably like a mile and a half west of town. And then the Glasses, Demos and Bill Glass, it's a father and son, they're Cherokee artists who do large sculptural installations all over the place. Their studio is on the other side of town. It's maybe 3 miles east of town.
That's wonderful. I hope none of those have been too negatively impacted with the going-ons of last year.
I don't think so.
Wonderful. I know this might be taboo, but do you have any plans for future exhibits that you're not quite refined yet that you're willing to share? Or maybe concepts that you would like to implement someday or thought about implementing, but never, you know, it just didn't fit?
I don't think so, although I'm not sure because I'm just so consumed with this one I'm doing right now. But inside the rummage store, I've always had a little space where there was like a poetry annex, because it was just a way of saying, hey, look, this is kind of neat, isn't it? Why don't you go out to the actual museum 2 miles outside of town? And I put a little annex exhibit in the rummage store where we opened right now. And it was called Mona's Closet. And what it was an exhibit inspired by the life of this woman who lived in town. I didn't use her real name. When she died, the man who bought her house, he just brought all her stuff to me. And she had tons and tons and tons of things that she had written in notebooks. And I figured out just by looking through all of this stuff that she was one of those people, the term has just left my head, but people who have a compulsion to write, there's a name for that. And so I did a little exhibit about that compulsion and the poetry in it. And it's just in a tiny room in the rummage store. And then I started taking it down when we started to move the museum. But I still feel like I want to do something with that someday, because the idea of combining the kind of a psychiatric disorder with poetry and what can come from that interests me. One of the main inspirations for the museum in the first place was when I visited the Glore Psychiatric Museum in St. Joseph, Missouri. It just, there was all kinds of poetic displays in there of things that the patients had done. And so it just, that's always been in the back of my mind, something about that psychology and poetry and the how they come together.
Yeah, it seems, and I don't mean to sort of wind things down of the idea of another very abstract question, but it seems very interesting. Over the course of this conversation, we've talked about, you know, the correlation of ethnobotany and psychiatry and all of these other subdisciplinaries of either soft science or humanities that fall sort of in tandem with poetry. And again, we referenced earlier the human experience. And do you think that you could describe what it is about humans, about those who write in margins and stuff, that is like worth emulating through poetry or exploring through different sort of artistic mediums?
Yeah, because that is the place where we're able to write or to draw, you know, if you're talking about art or to paint or whatever it be. That is a place where you get to explore your creativity in a way that doesn't have to have a rational meaning, and it doesn't have to be something that you explain, that has to be explained, and people can still appreciate it and gain awareness through it and have dialogues over it. Just because it's there, just because you're able to take a, like Wordsworth's definition of poetry was, it was an emotional experience recollected in tranquility. So to share an emotional experience with other people that you were able to create, probably in tranquility, I mean, that's mainly where we are able to experience our creativity, to share that, and it will evoke experiences and ideas and emotions and psychological changes and conflict and all of this stuff in the people that experience it. And that's what being human means.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that that's the way you feel. I agree completely. And again, on behalf of Oklahoma Humanities, I'm sure they feel a very similar way. Is there anything else you'd like to say? It's sort of on a broad, open-ended thing before I wrap this up. In terms of, you know, your work or your work in contingency with the pandemic or the future of humanities in Oklahoma?
I'm not sure.
It's a lot to put on the spot, admittedly.
I feel like I've just talked your ear off and going around and around. I think that the times are still ripe for people to be able to engage with one another, even if it's virtually, in with their ideas and their art and their creativity. And I think I plan on doing a podcast at the the new museum after we get that set up, and I want to bring people in. I want to have people come in off the street and, you know, read a poem and talk about it, and just to be able to continue to, you know, do what you love, express yourself through your art and your words. In whatever way that is, it doesn't mean that you have to feel like you call yourself an artist or you call yourself a writer, but that we all have these tools, you know, we all have these tools in common that we can use and to enrich our lives.
Nice, thanks. Well, I very much appreciate your time here. It's been very insightful, very wonderful. And
well, thank you. I appreciate you. I appreciate your questions and your research too. It's awesome.
Oh, thank you. Like I said, we appreciate the deed, and we'll let you know whenever this gets compiled. It may be a while for the transcriptions and stuff.
Okay.
But I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day, and good luck opening next month tentatively with the ROM.
Come see us.
Oh, I will. I will.
Okay.
Very interested. All right. Goodbye.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye.